once again to the Rosen's Gaming of Generation podcast. Before we introduce what we're doing this week, let's introduce our, I guess, our panel in progress, because we are expecting to have at least two more people join us. But if they don't, we have Anthony this week.
Hey, what's going on?
And returning after a very long hiatus, we have Daniel.
A far too long hiatus, if you ask me.
And 1 week, we are going to get into your adventures of interwebs over there in Jaio, England.
I'd rather not. It was bad enough going through it in the first place.
But yes, this week is going to be kind of our palate cleanser. For the past month, we've done nothing but top 7 list about this generation IPs, franchises, games, and stuff like that. And next week, we're going to try to determine our best games of this generation, and I'm assuming that's going to be a very peaceful podcast. This week, I figured we'll take a minor break and we'll just talk about games from this generation, our experiences, our thoughts. It won't be a list, it won't be a countdown, it won't be best and favorites, it will be anything you want to talk about. The floor is open. So, I guess to kind of open up the conversation and kind of get this kicked off, we've done this show for about 3 years now, so this is kind of known, but on the record, what systems in this past generation did you own?
I've owned all of them at some point.
Even a PSP?
Even a PSP.
Okay. Anthony?
Okay, you guys know I'm fairly pretty strong on Nintendo, so I had the DS, I had the Wii U, calling Wii U last generation, DS, Wii, and 3DS, and Xbox 360.
Okay, and I had a DS, a Wii, a PS3, and a 360. The only thing I didn't have was a PSP, but that's another subject for another day. So, we've all kind of had our experience of a well-rounded game library. I mean, if you have a 360 or PS3, you pretty much can account for 90% of either one of those libraries by just having one or the other. There are going to be some excuses we missed. The DS and the Wii were a bit more unique in that regard. And I think the PSP, a lot of their big games got ported up to the PS3 eventually.
I think that's a fair assumption. I mean, the PSP doesn't have... I mean, it has a very underrated library, I guess, the PSP was always like a niche thing. Like, I never actually saw, like, everybody who I owned that had a PSP, there was never that many games that sort of everyone that had a PSP had, which was kind of interesting. Like, I mean, DS, everybody had Pokemon at some point, and everybody had Super Mario 64, but... You know,
I never had Super Mario 64.
Well, it was very easy to find someone with Super Mario 64, whereas, PSP was, I didn't find that.
I mean, just to kind of jump forward a bit into this generation, I actually find that to be a most interesting thing with the 3DS is the Street Pass functionality, where you do get to see people play games, and you find that people have like the most... eclectic taste in games. Like, there are times, especially around launch, we will see people, like, Animal Crossing was big, Pokemon X and Y was big, stuff like that, but at the same time, I've seen people play Project X Zone, I've seen people play Phoenix Wright, I've seen people play Shin Megami Tensei, I've seen people who's like, it's like Nintendo Video, it's Nintendo Setting, it's Street Pass, so there are a lot of different types of gaming experiences on the handheld, and I think the PSP was good in that regard. I think the Vita is good in that regard as well, in that they offer a very diverse and very different lineup from what you get on the consoles. I think the PSP's biggest problem was that it just never took off the way Sony wanted it to, and the way developers never really supported it. With, like, you know, like we had early on, we had like the Metal Gear Acid games, and we had the Tales from, like, the Liberty City stories and Vice City stories and stuff like that. But after, like, yeah, 2 or 3, those types of spin-offs and side stories just weren't as abundant on the PSP because sales never really took off as they expected it to. And I feel like it was a huge missed opportunity for Sony and for a lot of Western developers to kind of expand their reach, especially in regards to kind of that kids and teen market.
I don't think it helps that the PSP doesn't really lend itself to, and the Vita, to some extent, they don't lend themselves. I mean, I know this isn't them, like, they're marketing them as, you know, you can carry your console games with you, but, like, that's, who really wants to do that, you know? I don't really know anybody that wants to do
that. Yeah, that's
why
I don't understand the cross-console, like, people, you know, touting that as a feature and stuff, that you can, you know, take your game on the go. It's like, do you really not have that much to do when you go out that you have to take your console game with you? Enjoy that at home. Enjoy your portable games if you want to do that on the road. Otherwise, just, you know, enjoy what you're doing outside of the home. You don't need to take that and make it every part of your life as much as, you know, publishers and salespeople might want you to.
Even if you have to be playing games while you're out, like most games on the 3DS, they lend themselves to, you can play it for 5-10 minutes and do one thing, and then you can shut it, put it back in your pocket, and, you know, carry on with it, whatever it is you're doing. Because Pokemon, you can go berry farming, or you can just go and breed something, or, you know, you can beat a gym, and then you shut it, you put it in your pocket, and you're done. Or you take your street pass, play all the games with the people you find, put it back in your pocket. Whereas the PSP had GTA, and GTA commands like 20, 30, 40 minutes at a time.
Yep.
And, you know, it just doesn't lend itself that well. And I think that's ultimately why it never took off, because people don't really want that kind of thing carrying with them. Because,
well, there are people who want it. It's just not a large enough market to really support anything. Because it's the same thing, again, jumping forward with Anthony saying, like, cross-play or cross-buy functionality, where it's like, it's good that you get these games, but how often do you kind of want to play a big console game on the go?
Right.
Where you, it's why mobile games have kind of taken off, is everybody wants those bite-sized games where you can play while you're online for 5 minutes at a checkout, or while you're on the bus or the train, or during lunch time at work or something like that. Not something you have to sit there and invest 2 hours into.
Right, right.
I think it's interesting, because I've just realized this, that the whole idea that the DS and the 3DS fold and you shut them, it basically says, I'm done for now, you know? Whereas the PSP and the Vita, they're just kind of these big blocks that slide in your pocket and fill it up.
2DS.
You can't, you know, you can't carry that in your pocket, you know, which is, it's kind of strange, but, you know.
To be fair, I don't think the XL fits in many pockets either.
Truth.
I have no problem fitting the XL in my pockets. I can fit the XL and more stuff in my pockets.
Well, you must have some really hard hipster pockets like those, but I know pockets that people take, the zipper pockets that people have.
Well, disclaimer, hipster pockets are usually pretty small.
Yeah, so to say, skinny jeans. Okay, apparently, I don't put my handheld in my pocket, but they are portable, either in my jacket pocket or maybe in I carry around either a messenger bag or like one of those shoulder book bags most of the time.
Oh, that is what I'm excited about with colder weather, because, I mean, I don't... That is the one downside of the 3DS, in my opinion, is that it doesn't fit comfortably in a back pocket, and my front pockets are full. It's just big, so jacket pocket would be great, but otherwise, that's the only thing I miss about my original 3DS, is the size factor.
Yeah, I prefer my 3DS, and it was fantastic over the summer because it fits perfectly into all of my shorts pockets.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't fit into any of my jeans, or especially like my work pants pockets, so there's that. Aside from size mattering, I guess really quickly, since we haven't really talked about this much during our series, what were your thoughts on the DS and some of your favorite games for that?
Every Phoenix Wright game on the thing?
Yeah, the DS introduced some fantastic, you know, new IPs. You have Phoenix Wright, you have Professor Layton, you have Trauma Center, and it, you know, expanded on other franchises in ways that were only done on 3DS, so... You wouldn't see, I mean, I guess you could, because wasn't Phoenix Wright actually a Game Boy Advance game?
Yeah, in Japan, originally, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, for most part, those were made possible or, you know, accessible through the use of a touchscreen, and then you take a look at, you know, existing franchise that uses it in a clever way. One of the most unique and best games on the DS, which was Kirby Canvas Curse, and then I didn't get a chance to play much of Squeak Squad, Mass Attack. But that apparently used it in a great way as well. Those are all fantastic games for it.
I still want to get that. I played the demo, and I really hated the setup for the DS demos, but Yeah, I really wanted to get that. It's just like every time it comes up on sale, I either miss it or I'm in the middle of something else and I don't want to add it to my collection. But the demo was extremely fun, and it is an interesting use of the touch screen. Yeah, there was a lot of interesting features of the DS. I think the one that usually got me in trouble was any game that had you shout into the microphone, which I think Phoenix Wright you could do.
Yeah.
You could also press a button or something as well. And I believe in Bowser's Inside Story, you had to use it for some of his attacks.
I love the microphone minigames in WarioWare.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I forgot about touched. I'm not a fan of, you know, scribbling across the touchscreen very much just because I'm worried about it scratching. But there are some games that you might risk it with. Bowser's Inside Story, I didn't care about that as much. Those are just, like, swipes. But you take a look at Elite Beat Agents, for example, that has some really, really great touchscreen. Thanks.
Yeah, it was a fine little system. Extremely great if you're a fan of RPGs. I would probably say the RPG system of the generation, but yep. I am not an expert on that. And a lot of interesting mini, like the whole touch generation was a novel movement. You got stuff like Brain Age, Brain Training.
Yeah, that's before the App Store really took off.
Yeah. I mean, it was part of the reason the App Store really took off is because Nintendo kind of expanded these type of bite-sized games, and I think, you know, like, for the time they were well, but yeah, at $40 a pop, they were hard to sell, $30 a pop, I guess, they were hard to sell than getting them for free or getting them for a buck or two on your phone for the similar experiences. But yeah, stuff like that, Brain Age was extremely well. You kind of mentioned Elite Beat Agent, which is a bit more sophisticated, Electro-Plankton. I guess even Phoenix Wright technically falls into that because they advertise that as... No, not Phoenix Wright. Professor Layton, they advertise that as a puzzle game. Well, it is a puzzle game, but they advertise that as like a brain teaser in Europe, don't they? Like, if you like Brain Age, you'll enjoy Professor Layton, there we go.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it makes it clear that it's a puzzle game instead of a Brain Age kind of game, but they obviously try and market it towards those kind of people. And it works. It works.
It does. It's a point and click. It's a very nice, you know, I think that's a franchise that doesn't get enough love, even though it sells well. I think it always drives under the radar for people. I am a huge fan of Professor Aiden, and I can't wait to see him return next year, even though he's around, like, every year nowadays.
He missed this year. This is the first year, and it's a series that I think he's missed.
But it's all right, because we get a Phoenix Wright Layton game next year.
Well, we get both next year.
Yeah.
Well, some of us. I don't know about Europe because you people are way ahead of us on the Nintendo calendar, apparently. Not bitter at all.
No, of course not.
Speaking of Nintendo exclusive games in Europe, did you ever try Disaster Day of Crisis?
No. This is the first time I've actually heard of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Disaster Day of Crisis was probably the most American game to be released, not in America this generation. It's basically a B-level disaster action movie. And it looks like it's made for the American audience. It looks like it's for the American audience, and it doesn't come out in America. So, but yeah, I guess...
Oh, it's a monolith. That's why it came out in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. We'll kind of get into Operation Rainfall in a bit, but I guess, you know, switching over gears, I guess, to the big boys as they are, the console space.
Operation Moonfall.
What's Operation Moonfall?
Getting Majora's Mask to the 3DS.
That's a bit different. Is there an actual movement for that?
I believe so. I mean, there was a while back.
I will say I always find it weird how fans are always clamoring for something new, but they are also the same people who ask for like a remake or a sequel to something they love.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Well, Operation Moonfall has 40,000 likes on Facebook.
That is almost as much as Time Fitness 4 campaign. Not to rub any salt into Daniel's wound.
My wound too. Let's be real.
It's alright, I get to play Reborn, and that's looking pretty good actually. Rewind even, so I'm not really concerned at the moment.
It's an odd thing that they waited until the end of the generation to kind of do that. But I guess
yeah.
it's, so it's not, it doesn't really
matter.
But
you get it on PS4, so, you know, not every, like, it's not just going to be a PC-only thing because of that. So it kind of works.
It's still kind of weird. I mean, they had this entire generation. They had this movement. They could have done it last year or even this year, and I think it would have been a fine Summer of Arcade title or something like that, instead of kind of pushing it out
there.
Well,
it's not. It's just a mod. It's done by an amateur team. It's not anything official.
I know it's not them, but I still think that it should have been something. You know, it should have been something Crytek or Free Radical worked on. We saw, like, there was a period of time, which I want to say is a long time, that's probably still going on, where kind of HD remakes of classic games were a big thing. You know, you had Bionic Commando, you had Bomberman Make for Resurrection. Most of the Xbox Live Arcade titles were originally like upports, like Genesis titles or arcade games and stuff like that. So there was a big movement. And then you had stuff like Perfect Dark.
Oh, man. That was such a good remake. Yeah, I mean, Crytek should have done it, but they didn't, because ultimately they don't care, so, you know.
They care enough in that they can get fans to support them, but it won't
Well,
make
yeah,
them.
But they care enough to say, oh yeah, you can do it for free. Okay. You know, that's not really caring a whole lot, is it?
Well, I mean, it's money is money. That's a big problem. But we're going to take this very brief second to introduce Sam, who has joined us in progress.
Hey, what's up?
And then Sam is not extremely loud right now, so there's that.
Oh, shoot, 1 second. let me play with some settings. Go on and continue.
Okay, while you're playing with that settings, just real quick. We're talking about this generation. What consoles did you own?
PlayStation, all of them. PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. I got a PC really late into it, but I still tried to play PC games. But when I tried to play them, it was usually, like, League of Legends or something, and then forced through a very poor graphics card.
Well, it's not a graphically intensive game, is it?
It wasn't, no. But, I mean, you don't understand how poor my graphics card was. Minecraft isn't a very intensive game either, and that was, not the most smooth game played.
Console space, I guess, and we have kind of a rough survey on the site if you want to throw that out and check that out. And this is a really odd question, but I'm kind of curious about this. I don't think we talked about this much. I don't really think people talk about this much. What was the game that kind of made you know or feel that quote-unquote next-gen had arrived?
House of the Dead Overkill.
House of the Dead Overkill. That is an interesting pick.
It's unrelated, but I just remembered and I wanted to bring it up that I bought Typing of the Dead Overkill. And it's fun.
House of the Dead Overkill is one of my favorite games of this generation. And honestly speaking, any game I like this generation, you're probably going to hear me say this is one of my favorite games of this generation. But it was a very, very great throwback to like the Grindhouse movie feel, and I love the score of that game so much. It's a truly magnificent rail shooter, and I would say this much. I think, even though in hindsight it probably wasn't the best thing for the Wii's extended audience, I do love that the Wiimote made a resurrection of kind of the rail shooter on consoles and made them functional, because we got that, we got Ghost Squad, even I think Medal of Honor Heroes had a rail shooting mode in it.
Was the Dead Space one?
Oh yeah, Dead Space Extraction.
I think that was the only one I played.
Yeah, great, a ton of rail shooters, but House of the Dead Overkill, I think, was my favorite. I think because, and this is something I learned about myself throughout this generation, and mostly at the start of this generation with games like Lego City and Wonderful 101, but also stuff like Kid Icarus and Azura's Wrath, is I prefer a game that doesn't take itself seriously at all. So, go over the top, go bizarre, go cheesy, go nonsensical, and that works in video games because it tends to match the action on the screen. And House of the Dead Overkill did that. It was extremely funny, which I've mentioned before. I think is a very hard trait for games to play off properly.
Kind of made Guinness Book of World Records.
Yes. Until I forget what game usurped it. Was it Mafia 2?
Mario Party 9. They had online play where you could listen to anyone that got to play Chance Time. And there's all their stars.
I would imagine if there was online recording, Mario Kart would take the cake for most F-bombs dropped. I still think the blue shell should become a curse word in our language.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, instead of flipping someone the bird, there needs to be a symbol for blue shell. Like, cup your hand and hold it down and just kind of wave it at the person you don't like. Very, very angrily.
The blue shell has started and ended so many friendships. But yeah, I mean, there were other rail shooters. Kinect didn't have any major rail shooters, did it?
Do you count Gunstringer?
Kind of, I guess.
I mean, that's the closest thing it had that's a successful rail shooter, anyway.
I actually had Gunstringer. It's probably my favorite Kinect game, which isn't saying a ton, but yeah, motion gaming was an interesting movement, no pun intended, this generation.
Yeah, it was totally intended. Don't lie to us.
It wasn't intended. I noticed it once I said it. But, yeah, I mean, we had the Wiimote, of course. We had Kinect, and we had the PS Move. And I think, you know, for the most part, I think the Wiimote was decent. It had a ton of potential that never realized, but it did give us some interesting games. I mentioned the abundancy or the resurrection of rail shooters. We got Wii Sports, Wii Sports Resort, which were, you know, fantastic little sports mini games. I will swear by Red Steel 2 as being one of my favorite first-person shooters of this generation. If you want to call it that, first-person brawler, first-person action game, whatever you want to dub it.
So that was Red Steel 2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not Red Steel 1. Never Red Steel 1. Yeah, you know, we got stuff like that. I've said it before, and I'm not ashamed. I'm a huge fan of, like, Just Dance and Dance Central. And I guess technically, even though these started at the end of Last Gen, I would say Guitar Hero and Rock Band are also part of that kind of motion movement, and that you got up and did something different in front of a TV screen with gaming. And those were hugely successful games as well. It's sad that those kind of wore thin really quickly.
I wouldn't even say that it wore thin, because I still have groups of friends that play it every weekend. They wore thin in that the game stopped coming out, but they stopped needing to come out.
The problem is they had the business model completely wrong for those games. You know, selling expensive plastic peripherals all the time, you know, releasing new games like cheap $40 games with just new songs on them. That's completely the wrong way they should have done it. They should have partnered with record labels and said, hey, if you buy this album, you get this album in the game. You know, stuff like that. You know, they got it all wrong. There was no easy way to buy the DLC. The DLC wasn't cheap. You know, it wasn't easy. Like, the plastic peripherals changed all the time, and you couldn't use the old ones with the new games just because it had some new gimmick. And then they ended up removing the gimmick on the ones that came after that. They needed to have one design for the instruments. You needed to be able to buy them separately at a decent price, you know. And then you needed to be able to buy the extra songs or albums for the games in an easy fashion that made sense. But they couldn't nail that, which is why I think they brought, and Activision's We Must Beat This Home Until People Stop Buying It didn't help either.
Yeah, but I'd argue that Activision isn't too bummed out by the results. They just kind of run things to the ground and move on. And their market, their business model worked extremely well for them. They made.
I think the business models didn't lend themselves to longevity.
That is true.
Well, I think they could have. I mean, again, kind of jumping forward to what we're seeing now, and maybe it was ahead of its time. But look at what Nintendo's doing with Wii U Karaoke. The idea of you don't buy the service, you rent the service. So if you want to do, like, you get 1,000 songs, but you have to rent it for $2 for a night or something like that. That, I think, makes a lot more sense, because if you have a bunch of friends over, that's fine. Like, I mean, Rock Band, I was a huge fan of, but how often do you actually sit there and play the music on your own?
Yeah.
But, you know, a weekend with some, you know, some drinks and some friends, I wouldn't mind paying $2-$3 for that. And if you do it every weekend of the year, they get $150. You don't realize it because you're not paying for it up front.
See, now you're assuming too much. You're assuming that I have, you know, friends to drink with and play karaoke with.
I'm just saying in general.
Yeah.
That the idea is to sell it piecemeal, and that's kind of what we're seeing now with free to play games. Is you don't sell it to the person up front. You make them buy it on the backside, and they don't realize it, because if I spend $2 this week and I spend $3 next week and I spend $5 a week after. I don't mind that it's $10, but if I was to tell I have to pay $10 up front, it's like, you know, I could probably wait until this is cheaper.
Yeah.
And I think music games were ideal for that. Like Daniel said, I think the idea of buying new instruments every year or spending $100 every year on a game didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense no matter how you cut it in the business model, but they wanted that revenue source and they didn't know how to get it any other way because, like, you don't buy new DVD players every time you get a new DVD. That would be ridiculous. You buy a DVD player for $100 and you get the movie to $10-$15. That's cheaper to a lot of people, or renting or Netflix. But yeah, I do think that we could possibly see a resurrection of that this generation. Even though I think we kind of moved on to toys now with Skylanders and Disney Infinity.
If anything, that's worse.
It's worse, but it's better in some regards because they're smart enough to realize that, you know, like, you can beat the game without these toys, but we're just going to hide little snippets of it everywhere, and you're going to be tempted to find out what's behind that door, even if it's nothing. So you're going to want that fire figure, or you're going to want that ice figure to get through that door. And I think, I mean, personally speaking, I've said this before, I think a tangible reward is a lot more engaging or, you know, tempting to me than a DLC pack or a digital code. Granted, I haven't supported either of these games yet, so I'm not really the market audience, the target audience, I should say. So yeah, I guess that was Motion. I guess the other big advent in this generation, or kind of something that took more of the forefront, was online gaming in the console space. And we saw that really kind of exploded with Halo 3 and then Call of Duty 4 that same year.
But that's not new to this generation at all.
But I think it took off this generation. Like, we had Halo 2, and there were a couple of games on the original Xbox, but, I mean, if you compare Xbox Live, there are more Xbox Live subscribers now, Go subscribers, than there are Xbox owners.
Being somebody who played Halo 2 online on the original Xbox, playing Halo 3, because that's pretty much why I bought a 360 in the first place, playing Halo 3 was like, This is when the next generation, because, like, it was just so much easier. Everything was so much easier, because on the original Xbox, there was no system-wide friends list. The games had them. And sometimes you'd be playing a game, and it supported, you could send a message to a friend, but you couldn't voice chat them. Or you could voice chat them, but you couldn't send a message to them. Or you could do neither, you just knew they were online. It was ridiculous. But
but what about the clan support from Halo 2? I love being called a peon in Halo 2. I completely agree with you.
But it was so much easier, and then when I found out that once you've played a game and you wrecked face, you could save that game and send it to your friends, and they could go, oh my god, you were so good in that game. That was it. That was it.
I never used that.
I love this.
Like, yeah, but I would
then,
still say that.
And then you find out that you can make your own levels. They make a map for you that's just a blank slate, and you can build your own levels in that map. Oh.
I wish I had your optimism about video
Halo
games.
3 was
I was
so
not.
Good.
Wow, somebody's calling Daniel the optimist on this show. That's the first. But yeah, I think, you know, like, I think if you hadn't played online gaming with the original Xbox, even PS2, you didn't realize how big of a difference Xbox Live was. Like, there were no standard systems for that, and there were games where it was just really difficult, and it was something you had to plan ahead of time with friends and all this other stuff. Xbox Live, especially where it is now, because at the start of this generation, it was rough, and as it went on, they've added more and more stuff. I think the parties chat is a godsend, as far as...
You can
as
thank not- Halo 2 for that.
Yes. As far as not hearing ignorant, racist, bigotry, sexist remarks, and just kind of listening to friends. I mean, in some regards, it did kind of suck, because one of the bigger games for me early in this generation, and I think one of the first games that kind of made me realize this generation existed, was Gears of War. And Gears of War was built around the idea that once you died, you would be muted. So you couldn't tell your teammates where everybody else was in the game.
Gears of War was built around the idea of, guess what, you're in college and you have an exam to study for the next day, so we're going to make a game where you get taken out of the round, and you've got about 45 seconds to 3 minutes at the end of each round to study while you can still play video games.
if you were good, sometimes you had like a whole 10 minutes. My favorite thing about Gears of War was always when it came down to one versus one, because both of them would be hiding and not doing anything. You're just shouting at the screen, "Is it right around the corner? Just turn around."
Yeah, and they can't hear you, and then you get shotgunned because you mess up, and you hear, "What the fuck?"
that was always
at you constantly.
That was always great, because you would have the Deadpool, again, no pun intended, and the moment somebody died, they would be talking about something else, and it would be cut into the conversation as they switch over, and that was always kind of jarring. But yeah, once they introduced party chat, that kind of broke the game, because everybody just kind of part. I think at some early on, the game kind of blocked you from using party chat in general. But
I think the first game to do that was Modern Warfare 2. Like, games didn't really start blocking you from party chat until Call of Duty, where it's like, whoa, hold on. We take our game way too seriously to do this, even though they don't have. Whatever. Anyway, I agree with you, though. Yeah, online multiplayer, now that you say that, like, you're right. It has changed a huge amount since the early Xbox days. My first online... Oh, go ahead, Anthony. You haven't talked in a while, so I will turn the mic over to you.
No, I don't got too much to say about that. I mean, I agree that, back then, when you thought about online play, Xbox Live, it was Halo 2. That was, you know, that was the first foray. But now you go into, you know, how much we take for granted and how much, you know, we expect with party chat, with invites, being able to, you know, cross-game chat. This generation was the first big step into, you know, consoles that are connected online and trying to connect the community. And Nintendo tried to do that. This time around with the Wii U, with Miiverse, and, you know, implementing community into single-player games like New Super Mario Bros. U. But, you're also seeing that as the reason why, like the creators of SimCity tried to make it an online-only game, and we're starting to see, you know,
Yeah, that was the reason.
But yes, I guess what Sam is hinting at is the other side of online gaming, which is the evilness of like online passes and kind of DLC and microtransactions, which were a big part of this generation. And in theory, a lot of that stuff was a good idea implemented badly or poorly across this generation. The idea of, if you were to tell me when I was 6 years old that in the future when I beat a game that somebody's going to offer me more of that game for a cheaper price, I'd be super excited. The notion that they're offering you more of that game because you took it out because you wanted to charge you extra later on is what kind of disappoints.
And nowadays it's like, oh, there's DLC for this game? Really?
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. It's like, when you hear about it, it's just... It's gotten to the point where people announce that they're not doing DLC for their games.
Right.
To make, you know, like, I think Nintendo just came out and said that they're not doing DLC for Super Mario 3D World. Like, because it is kind of jarring, especially once you get to... WWE 2K14, which just came out. And they have an entire trailer with the DLC characters, and they're in the game. And I'm just thinking, like, you're doing this before this game launches. You're telling me all these amazing characters, and why aren't they in the game?
Right.
Like, at least give me the notion that you're going to work on this after the game finished, and you had crunch time. Not like, oh, we finished this. We just want to charge you more later on.
Yeah, see, you made me think about, like, thought that I liked DLC up until 5 minutes ago, actually. Like, until you start talking, I was one of those people that's like, yeah, DLC is a good thing. They get to give you more content, you get to expand your experience, and I started thinking about it, and I've only really liked a handful of DLC, like, add-ons throughout the entire life cycle of the Xbox 360. The rest of them just felt like half-assed cash-ins.
Yeah, I would say I'm a huge fan of what Borderlands did with its DLC.
Borderlands, Minerva's Den, the Mass Effect DLCs have been all right, some of them. Mass Effect 2 DLCs, anyway.
Yeah, for Dead, I was a fan of their DLC policy. Partially because Valve is pretty nice, so you see, give you the first one free.
Yeah.
Well, they only charge you because they have to.
Yeah, that was the other thing that came out. Is like, because during the... original Xbox, Microsoft would give you free Halo 2 maps. You didn't pay for it.
I remember that.
In fact, I remember paying for them, and then like 2 weeks later, they were free after that, and I was like, well, why the hell did I pay for them?
Yeah, they did that with Gears of War as well. Like, I think it was like the first 6 months it was paid for, and then after that it would become free for everybody. And they stopped that policy because...
Yeah, I'm kind of pissed they stopped that, actually.
Because I can understand why, because people get upset. But what happened was, we didn't get the opposite of that, where like you don't get any benefit for buying it earlier, and they don't tend to do like discounts. Like, oh, Gears of War is like... It's what, 7 years old now. Here's the maps for like 90% off or something because nobody else is playing this game. No, it's just like, oh, okay, you got these map packs. Here's a new $60 game for you.
Yeah, exactly.
We've gone to the point where if I want to buy Battlefield 4, the complete edition, right now, I have to pay $84.98 for it, and it came out the other day.
Yeah. Or like I went on to play Halo. What's the most Halo 4? Halo 4 is online multiplayer the other day, and I basically can't play any of the new game types because they all require DLC. And at this point, there's like $30 of DLC that I have to buy just to be able to play all the game modes that originally came with my game perfectly fine.
Well,
they've disabled
some of
the stuff.
Depending on who you ask, that might be them doing you a favor not playing Halo 4 online.
Well,
I will say this much for Halo 4 and even Halo Reach. They are nice enough to give you a lot of free game types and free like maps. Like they usually put up some community maps for free. So it's
yeah.
a freshly made one.
It is nice. I just don't like being locked out of game types that I use.
Oh yeah,
I guess.
That pisses me off. Like so I tried that the other day, and it's like you're missing the map content. And they don't even tell you which one. It's just like you're missing the content of greatest mode. I'm like, oh.
Right. I'm like, oh, let's go download it. Oh, it's $30. Well, never mind.
Yeah, like, again, I think the idea of DLC, great. The execution for, like, 90% of games is awful.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest offender, or I guess the culmination of this, is the season pass. Because it's kind of like buying a blind box, like a grab bag, and hoping for the best that you get out of it. It's like, you know, a lot of people are upfront nowadays, but, like, I think Batman Arkham City Origins, I should say, that was, like, 50%... character skins. And then the other stuff, they didn't exactly tell you what it was. They're just like, oh, yeah, it's story DLC. We won't tell you what, though.
I never figured why people even buy season passes anymore. I mean, like, because usually, in order to make sense, you have to buy every single piece of DLC, right? Well, why not just wait till the DLC releases and, like, pay your $5 tax on the off chance that you do want every single piece of DLC? Like, how do idiots keep buying these things?
Well, because, you know, fooling their money are soon parted. I think the other idea is that, you know, they kind of sell it as a discount. Like, oh, pay us $50 now and you'll save $10 on the long haul. And, yeah, like you said, like, part of the problem with that is you don't necessarily know if you're going to want this content. You also don't know if you're going to be playing this game. And a lot of this stuff, like, I think BioShock had a season pass, or,
yeah.
I mean, like, the first BioShock DLC was in this summer, and the second one hasn't come out yet.
And the first DLC is crap. Who asked? Who sat there and said, the combat in this game is amazing, I want more of it? Who?
Ken Levine.
I want to strangle Ken Levine for thinking that.
He was sitting there at his desk. He goes, you know what this game needs more of? I know I made it and all, but yes. Survival-based, wave-based
combat. I bought the season pass because I thought, okay, we're getting more of Minerva's Den, and I'm sure that's coming with Burial at Sea. But Clash in the Clouds are downloaded, and I was like, you know what? I've paid for this already. I may as well just have a look at it. And I was, this is not, I don't want to play this after 2 minutes of loading the game. I was like, no. Hopefully Burial at Sea is actually good. Please, Ken.
Right.
I'm begging you.
I have confidence that that'll be fine. Based on Bioshock 2's DLC, anyways.
Yeah, and I guess the other offender of DLC would be the Capcom model, which is you have stuff on the disc, you lock it away so people can pay you to unlock
it. There's actually a new one emerging. There's a new one emerging, and it's bloody Gearbox. It's the let's release a season pass and DLC that's not included in the season pass, and then the Game of Year edition, and then more DLC after the Game of Year edition that you still have to pay for.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, that is right.
But yeah, the The Capcom model's like selling you some pants and then making you pay for the pockets on it.
Yeah, pretty much. Or making you pay to, open them up.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then if you find a workaround to it, then you get in trouble with them, even though the content is on the disc you bought. So
then you get your pants taken away.
So yeah, it's a very dubious process. I think I'm hoping in the future we'll see companies kind of treat it better. I mean, again, the idea of DLC is still great. It's just the execution for almost every company that needs to work on it. Like, the other problem I have with DLC, and this was supposed to be more of a positive podcast, but whatever. The other problem I have with DLC is, the sequels, it defeats the purpose. The whole point should be to extend the life of a game. If you get one every year, like, there's no life to extend.
Right. Also, while on the subject, airline food. I mean, that stuff just sucks, right? What else can we complain about?
Yeah, that's not complaining about stuff anymore.
The American government's lazy.
What were some of your favorite games? Some of your favorite experiences? Something new and exciting this generation?
Phoenix Wright. I'm going to say Phoenix Wright all the time. Every time. Phoenix Wright. I love it. And I would have had I not owned a DS, I wouldn't have played it. Like, not because you can't play it without owning a DS, but I wouldn't, like, the DS kind of introduced me to the whole, maybe it doesn't have to be a proper game for you to like it, you know?
Well, that is a proper game.
Well, it's not really. It's a visual novel with some puzzles. You know?
It's a point-and-click adventure.
It's not. It's barely a point-and-click. Barely.
I mean, you point-click on stuff,
he
tells you what it is.
You point at the box that advances the text, and you click it. That's as much.
You said point-and-click. There you go. But, yeah, I know we're supposed to be positive. That was something I really hated about this generation, though. This kind of mentality that popped up of us versus them, casuals versus hardcore, games versus non-games and stuff.
Yeah.
That nonsense that just existed so people could feel superior about their taste and, you know, kind of downplay somebody else's taste because they enjoyed a minigame compilation, because they enjoyed a point-and-click adventure, because they enjoyed a visual novel, and they weren't playing the next great, you know, 30-hour epic RPG or that cinematic AAA title or anything like that. That just pissed me off more than anything else this generation, because it's supposed to be a hobby of growth and expansion, not one of inclusion and defeatist. Like, this whole idea, like, there's only one type of game you can make.
No, it's frustrating because you have a bunch of games that are getting people to play games for the first time. People that might not, you know, that might have looked down on it and, you know, called it, you know, something for nerds and just shrug it off, get something that's accessible to them, and they realize they can have fun with it, and then you're playing games with people who might not play them before, and it's the lack of a better way to put it, it's the entry drug. Like, if, you know, if they like that, then maybe they'll, like, if they like New Super Mario Bros. U, maybe they'll like Super Mario 3D World, and then maybe then they can get into Galaxy or things like that.
A game is a game is a game, unless, of course, you play Dota, in which case you're an athlete, not a gamer, but that's a different conversation.
A whole different conversation.
Yeah, and eventually you go up that ladder, and then you get to Quap.
But yeah, that was something that pissed
Quap's
me off.
Quap's a suicide tool. That's not a game either.
I don't even know what Quap is.
It's that running game where you use Q, W, O, and P. So you should go play. It's pretty easy.
No,
The best sort of joking classification for a game or game non-game I heard is, can you jump in it? So that means that Gears of War is not a video game because you can't jump.
Jumping in first-person shooters in general is just a really bad idea.
Oh, no. Jumping's great.
No, jumping, I have jumping, but a lot of first-person shooters don't do it well because it's really hard to kind of get a read when you're in the first person of the hand and stuff like that.
Yeah. I just played, speaking of, like, not jumping, just a little bit of tangent, I played Alien Rage the other week for review, in that game, you have a jump button, but you can't jump over a single object in the entire game all the way through. Like, you don't jump over any rails. You don't jump over any boxes. There's, like, a crate that goes up to your shins, and you walk up to it, and you jump, and your feet don't even clear the bottom of the crate. It's just wow. The developers had a bet. It was like, hey, what can we do that Gears of War didn't do? Jump button. Yeah, it's perfect. What are we going to do? Don't worry about it. Just leave the jump button. It's fine.
Well, obviously, they wanted to make sure it was classified as a video game.
Yeah. Alien Rage, definitely a video game. Not a good one, but...
Definitely a video game.
It's the front box of those quotes. Can jump.
Can jump.
That's how I'm going to start reviewing games on the site. Can jump, can jump.
have a checkbox on the side. It's like a plus at the bottom. You know, it's like, plus, graphics are good. Plus, great story. Plus, can jump.
That's all you need in a game. But yeah, that was another thing. And I guess, you know, since I did bring that up, the other thing we kind of saw in the emergence of this generation was kind of that narrative-driven, cinematic experience-type games, which were really popularized by something like Uncharted, which I don't want to talk about too much. Because we talked about
if you haven't known about Uncharted yet, you really haven't been listening the last few weeks of podcasts.
Yes, we have talked about it, like the three out of the last four podcasts. It was
every single podcast I've been on, we talked about Uncharted.
It wasn't on the Xbox one, lucky enough. But yeah, Uncharted started that. We got stuff like Tomb Raider. Okay, Star Wars 1313 was going in that way. Enslaved, followed that design. And I think the design in itself, the idea of it's good. Again, it's something that the execution sometimes tends to leave you wanting. It's the same thing with stuff. I felt the same way playing games like Red Dead Redemption, LA Noire.
Or like Azure's Wrath. You said that was a fun game, but it also left, you know, obviously left a little to be desired in terms of gameplay. Like, I think developers haven't found the sweet spot between cinematic and gameplay yet, and hopefully that's something they figure out next generation.
Yeah, that reminds me, even though I never played it, I played the demo, Ninja Parade, I think it was? All I remember from that is, like, you're free falling out of the sky, and it's just a quick time event of you pressing buttons, and it can really cool while doing it. And I guess somewhat it's cinematic, but I think the Batman Arkham series has done a good job of kind of making this more in terms of, like, the combat. Because the combat really only has two buttons. It's attack and it's counter. Like, granted, you get other moves and stuff like that, but you can pretty much get through most fights with those two buttons. But they do it in such a way that it is skill-based, it is timing-based, and you're engaged in it the entire time without feeling like, oh man, Batman's just triggering this amazing cutscene I'm going to watch. I think Origins does kind of push that a bit with some of the cutscenes and some of the boss battles, but the boss battles in that franchise have always been weak.
Sure.
I don't know. I'm not really one to comment. I don't really find. I'm not really engaged by the combat in the Arkham games. I mean, I can see why people like it, but it just doesn't really do anything for me. So.
So what they need to do is play a little song in the background, because it's basically a rhythm game anywhere, so there's like a... It's like, counter, counter, punch, 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 counter, punch. It's great. That's what they need to do in the background. Just add all the Batman soundtracks to it.
What does suck, though, is when you think enemies are going to attack, and they just decide to stand there, and it screws up your combo because you didn't get the counter. Yeah. Whatever, enemies. You wanted to punch him in the back of the head, you knew it.
I really did like that combat system, though. I 100%ed the first Arkham Asylum, and that required getting, like, a 100-hit combo or something at some point. Getting those long combos once you spend enough time to understand the system is really fun. And you're right, it is fairly cinematic in the way it works when you're doing it right. Now, when you're not doing it right, no, the cinematic stuff breaks entirely, but, I mean, I guess you have to, you know, cut it off at some point.
And it was a fun game, and I think, you know, it's also balanced by the fact that that's not the OE method of combat. You do have the predator encounters, which does help to offer some diversity. Even though I find those to be a lot more monotonous than the combat, because it's really just kind of hanging out on a goal, waiting until somebody gets underneath you and vote him up.
Yep.
Yeah. But, again, still fun because they know it was always great with pacing, and one of the reasons I prefer Asylum over the other two is because it was a lot smaller package instead of trying to make it something much larger and longer than it needed to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess, this is one that I'm always curious about because we don't really talk about this much, but what games did you consider having the best graphics this generation?
Graphics or visual style?
That's always, I mean, I guess both, technically and artistically. Or a combination of the two. I don't, like, what would you consider the best?
Yeah,
that
requires some thought.
I like to hate on Halo 4, but the one thing I can't fault it for is it looks so good. I have to, like, I was playing it and I was, this is on an Xbox 360 still. Like, how? You know?
I had that moment with Grand Theft Auto 5 too.
Is how, at least when you split the screens, the frame rate definitely took a hit, but it was a gorgeous game, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't be playing split screen anything anymore. Like, developers just throw that in because for like the 10 people that still use it, which I actually still like split screen, but it's become impossible to.
No, I love it. I mean, TVs are big enough, it doesn't halter it anymore. And, you know, I have a roommate. We play, I mean, we like Halo 4's multi. We're one of the few people that prefer Reach. But we play Reach, you know, like every other night, split screen online. It's great.
I find it weird that in the generation where HD became standard and where the Archer TVs became standard, that couch play has become a special feature. Like, you would think bigger TVs, more room, instead of having like four people gathered around a 19-inch TV split into four corners.
Yeah. Do you remember how GoldenEye on Wii was marketed because, you know, something that was great about it was that it had split screen like the old GoldenEye. Like, that was a selling point.
Yeah, I remember how well that sold.
Nope.
It didn't.
I wrote the guide for it, so.
But, I mean, I think part of the reason it didn't, I mean, I was going to say part of the reason it didn't sell was because it was a Wii game, but that actually.
But that, well, that well. Is that is true.
It didn't sell well in the HD Twins either. I think part of it was just that.
It's not Call of Duty. It's not Halo.
Well, I think that and the Bond license has kind of, I mean, like, even though I thought GoldenEye was a great game, it's like between GoldenEye and GoldenEye, there was a lot of iffy games in between it, and the franchise doesn't hold that relevance anymore. I also think that GoldenEye Rogue Agent Last Generation hurt it as well. Because you can only use that name so often before.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, it means nothing.
The thing I don't think they sold that well because GoldenEye is, like, James Bond isn't, like, they're not films about just pure shooting people, you know?
Best for us in Error War.
Yeah, but for the most part, James Bond's not about pure shooting people, so why would you make video games about pure shooting people?
I was about to say, what do you want, a dating sim thrown on the side of it? Like, I don't know.
Well, no, I think before, all you need to do is you take the gameplay of Uncharted, right, tone down the amount of platforming, and put James Bond skins on it, and there you go, you've got a perfect James Bond game.
I was going to say, personally speaking, my favorite Bond game of all time is Everything or Nothing, because that's a mixture of first-person shooting, that's a mixture of different types. You know, you have a helicopter chase, you have a motorcycle chase, you have a car chase, and a lot of gadgets and stuff like that, and that's what makes Bond to me. So I think if you were to use a modern-day equivalent, and they tried this with Judgestone, it didn't work as well as intended, but if you were to take something like Splinter Cell Conviction and kind of make the stealth, make it more integral, but not as kind of heavy-handed, I think that's what you would use for a Bond game. Because, like Daniel says, he isn't about shooting a lot of the times. I mean, the Brosnan era, especially, you know, that's where GoldenEye came from, was that kind of, like, shooty-shooty, bang-bang stuff. But Daniel Craig's one has kind of toned it down. I mean, especially Casino Royale, where you get, like, a half-an-hour card scene.
Well, we haven't learned how to make a game that doesn't have shooting in it yet. Like, even Uncharted, like you said, Nathan Drake kills an ungodly number of people in that game. We haven't. That's one thing I hope for next generation, is that we learn how to make games that don't all involve shooting people.
Well, I mean, we can kind of do that. You mean, you take franchises and put guns in them, and they turn good. You just look at Shadow the Hedgehog.
or one of my personal favorites from this generation, Bomberman Zero.
Oh.
Wait, what?
Bomberman Act Zero. If you
I thought you said Bomberman Hero. I was like, don't knock that game.
No.
Bomberman, where he became like this gruff military man.
Yeah, they're like robots, and, you know, take it in the top-down perspective and put them in the exact same blocky environment. How could that go wrong?
It kind of looked like Unreal Tournament Bomberman. I don't know, but that was a terrible decision. I heard so many things about Bionic Command, though. What was Rearm? No, not Rearm. Which was the actual sequel, not the remake? Rearmed was the remake, right?
The thing was just called Bionic Commando.
Oh, okay. But yeah, like this whole, and I think that, you know, I think one of the major things we saw this generation, for better or worse, was kind of this irrelevancy of Japanese developers as they kind of tried to chase that Western buck. We saw Resident Evil become more action focused. We saw Bomberman become a third person shooter. We saw a lot of franchises just kind of try to become AAA shooting affair with unnecessary multiplayer and stuff like that. And a lot of, most of the franchises failed in that regard because they're trying to mimic a style that they don't know how to make in a genre that doesn't make sense for the characters they have.
The problem is the Japanese haven't fixed the problems that they've always had, which is, like, have you ever played a Japanese game and go, my God, this interface is awful? Happens way too often. The interface in the new Pokemon games, they are terrible. Japanese, they need to fix their interface design because it's something you shouldn't think about.
I was going to say, the problem with Pokemon, I just feel it's like they have so much information they want to relay to you at once.
Well, yeah, that's poor interface design. You know, I have to go with it, like, if I want to heal a Pokemon, I have to go into my bag, I have to pick the pocket, and then I have to pick the item, then I have to pick use, and then I have to pick the Pokemon I want to use it on. Like, it shouldn't be that hard. Especially
if everything, there's a text pop-up box telling you what to do. You pick the item. Like, you have selected Charmander. You have selected heal.
I have a
Charmander is healed 20.
I have a touch screen, yet the game gives me a yes or no option on the top screen and doesn't let me pick on the bottom screen. Like, why? Why do I have to press down, then A, to pick no instead of yes? You know? And it's just little things like that that the Japanese just haven't worked out yet. And, you know, they don't need all this multiplayer progression systems. They just need to keep making the games that they were making in the way that they were making them. They just need to polish them, because that's something that the Japanese have never been particularly good at.
It's polish?
Polish, yeah.
Huh, I don't know many.
I mean, there are exceptions. I mean, pretty much everything released by Nintendo ever.
I guess Resident Evil 6 existed, but I was going to say, I don't know many buggy Capcom games, but I guess Capcom versus...
No, I don't mean fixing bugs, I just mean, like, just making sure the interface makes sense, and, you know, and, not making everything needlessly complex.
I see, what you're asking for is Japanese games to go back to doing what they're doing, but also not, because the needlessly complex nature, that's kind of what Japanese games are.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, Japanese games are great for being crazy. I mean, a Western company would have never made Phoenix Wright, because, you know, it's got, like, a sense of humor and a way it conducts itself, and it knows what it has to be, you know? And same, like, Vanquish and Bayonetta, for example, they are very good Japanese games. I don't, like, yeah, okay, they didn't sell that well. The interface is in those games, they never get in the way of what you're trying to do. The games are very self-aware, you know, they're crazy, they're fun, they're fast, you know, I wouldn't call them typical Japanese games. Platinum are very good at making Western games.
They're very good at making Platinum games, but I want to continue this conversation just really quick since he's stepping out. I want Anthony's kind of thoughts on this generation before he goes. Like, your overall, I guess, thoughts, which your takeaway.
The takeaway of the generation and thoughts of it, it's, you know, it's I'm trying to think. It's been a long one, one of the longest ones, but...
Longest one.
Yeah, it's the longest one, and it's just interesting to see how much it's changed when you go from... the systems before it, you have the GameCube, Xbox, and PS2, you know, you just put discs in, and it just, you know, plays the disc, not too much menu stuff aside from that, maybe some sound settings, some video settings, aside from that,
keep going.
Oh, okay.
That was good.
Anyhow.
But this time around, like, you could say that this generation was defined almost by, you know, the system outside
of the games themselves. So you have Xbox Live, which led to Xbox Live Arcade, which led to apps outside of it. And you had one of the last reveals from the Wii was the home menu, where you see all those channels with Virtual Console, and you guys remember Everybody Votes Channel and Nintendo Channel and things like that. And you have PS3 whatever that menu system's called, but it took strides to turn them from simple video game machines to entertainment centers, for better or for worse. Some people just, want to sit down and play games, but some other people enjoy what they have to offer. But then obviously aside from that, you have what we've been talking about with DLC, with increased online stuff. So it's interesting to see where that's going to go going forward. But, when it comes down to it, there's still certain amount of charm in just games that do games well. I played Earthbound for the first time just a few months ago, and that's still for me almost as fun as some of the new stuff that's coming out. And this generation provided a lot of that, and provided a lot of innovation, a lot of unique stuff. And it's kept me interested as busy as my life is getting. Still find some time to play games. So it's this is the first generation where I've purchased most of my stuff, and it's been a good one. So cut the music. We can add that in.
Okay. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. My graduation hat.
I appreciate it, guys. I will I'll catch you guys later.
Later.
Boy.
Bye.
Okay, so Daniel, you were talking about like Platinum Games, who I think they're an example of where Japanese developers need to go in the future, and that they do different types of genres. They've done shooters, they've done beat-em-ups, they've done character action games, and they're all unique, but they're really solidly made. I think giving them a budget and maybe extra time to polish them would go far, but that's about it.
Well, I think the only problem that Platinum has, really, is they make short games for the most part.
I don't know if that's true. I wouldn't Bayonetta was, 10 hours, and The Wonderful 101 is like 15, around 10 to 12. I think their problem is really marketing. It's like really hard to market their games because their games isn't like it's not something you just kind of show.
Definitely a lot of Japanese developers could learn from Platinum because Platinum know what they're doing. They doesn't matter what they do, they know what they're doing, and I don't like Devil May Cry because there's too much running around and pointless puzzles in it, and I just don't understand why they're there, whereas Bayonetta has none of that. And if there are puzzles in the game, most of them are relating to, you need to use your witch time to get over this gap. So it's about mastering, what is the core of the game, which is certain combat mechanics. And, they don't have any filler in them. They don't have needlessly silly things that are just they're not padded. They're not they don't have any things that just seem to be there. You can just ignore them, but they're there for the sake of it. I mean, they're simple, they're fun. They know exactly what they're trying to be. They're very self-aware, and I think that's all Japanese games need to be. They don't need to, let's take Final Fantasy, for example. Square Enix, I don't care what anyone says, Square Enix doesn't know what they're fucking doing with Final Fantasy anymore. They made an MMO they made an MMO that they had to remake from scratch. We had Final Fantasy 13 3 for some strange reason, because, they basically made 13, and then 13 2 was, let's make the opposite of 13, because that's what everybody wanted. And now we've got 13.3, which, let's just turn the tits up on lightning a little bit, please. I don't understand, what is Square Enix doing? They have an advisory board in the company for quality control in Final Fantasy. That's not, when you have that, you need to stop making them, You need to stop making them, go right back to the drawing board and start again.
I don't think they need to stop making them. I think what they need to stop doing, and this wasn't a problem, I think this generation is kind of a culmination of their problem, is that they threw Final Fantasy on anything because it was a brand that people knew. So, we've got Final Fantasy 13-2 Lightning's Return, which is fine, because that's but, you know, you get stuff like Final Fantasy Tactics, you get stuff like Final Fantasy Advance, you get stuff like the Crystal Bearers, you get stuff like, you know, this and that, the PSP fighting game and stuff like that, and that's where it becomes an issue, because then there's no such, you know, like, you're just kind of throwing it on there, and it's not necessarily a quality control, in comparison, and, you know, I'm sure people have their opinions on this, but almost anything Nintendo throws Mario's name on tends to be a quality product, and it tends to be built around the idea of the Mario universe and those characters. Like, you know, we've had this discussion on this site before about Mario RPG kind of not feeling like a Mario game, but other than that, like, you can distinctly see the qualities of a Mario game in everything that he's in, where, like, Final Fantasy, because it's such a... it's more of a brand than it is anything else. Like, there isn't a defining characteristic that they can apply to all of these games. So it's just like, we'll call this Final Fantasy and we'll call that Final Fantasy. And I think, you know, more than Final Fantasy 13 and the two sequels, I think the thing that really kind of pushed people over the edge is Final Fantasy or the Bravest.
Yeah.
Which is just like, you know what, we're going to put this, a big brand on this really crappy mobile game that's even terrible for a mobile game. And it's like, that's showing no respect to your franchise.
That's actually probably a better explanation of the problem that the Japanese game industry have. They seem to be doing things for the sake of it, instead of doing things that are actually meaningful.
Well,
you know?
Like I said, I think the problem was they were chasing, and this is a problem I think everybody was doing, but I think the major problem was that Japanese had franchises that they wanted to do this with, was that everybody was chasing that Call of Duty, that online multiplayer money, and you were taking franchises that didn't need it and were giving them multiplay, giving them some type of leveling up system, giving them more action because that's what people demanded.
And here's what I don't understand is, like, Resident Evil, for example. Like, the most successful one was Resident Evil 4 because it's the best one. And
actually, 5.
Well, really? Oh, that's kind of bad then.
5 actually this week became Capcom's best-selling game of all time.
Yep.
Well, I guess that's why Capcom.
Which proves that we don't know anything.
Yeah.
Well, what are we even doing this podcast for? It doesn't matter what we say.
I will say this much: Resident Evil 5 is my favorite Resident Evil game, so I'm part of the problem.
I guess I'm going to cut that point off then, because I was going to say,
you know what,
I was going to say Resident Evil 4 is the best one, and it was the most successful one, so therefore they should, like, in Resident Evil 4 had like the best sort of mix of kind of horror and action, but if that's not the case, then it's the point is moot, isn't it?
I think what Resident Evil needs is, I think part of the reason Resident Evil 5 is so successful is partially because Resident Evil 4 was so good. It's like that, it's that old thing in that you can see how well a sequel does by what comes after it. Like, if the sales, like Final Fantasy 15, I assume sales will drop off because of what we went through with Final Fantasy 13. But Resident Evil 4 was such a big shot in the arm for the franchise that Resident Evil 5 after it did so much better because people were ignited with the franchise. At the same time, there's a reason there's a fall off between 5 and 6 is because it wasn't what people expected from the game.
I guess so. I mean, that's a pretty good measurement, actually.
I was also going to say the major difference was Resident Evil 5 was on two systems, or Resident Evil 4 launched on the GameCube, which, so, yes, in the Wii balance for it. So,
well, not really, because 4 was on the PS2 and the Wii as well, so...
Eventually it came out on a bunch of systems, and it sold remarkably well. I mean, even on the GameCube, it crossed a million on every system it was on, so it's around 3 to 4 million. So it's not like it's a terribly... It's just that Resident Evil 5 did so much better. And I think part of it is because it has the design of Resident Evil 4, and I think online co-op helped. I think horror works well with a buddy, and that's a really odd thing to say. But I think going through something and there's a reason why slasher movies isn't usually just a monster versus one character the entire movie. That's kind of boring. When you get a group of characters, you can kind of pick them off. It's why F for Dead works. It's because...
Well, I mean, horror with groups can either make it or break it, because the other day I bought Outlast, and obviously there was a bunch of people over this weekend, and we played it, and it was great, because everyone was scared shitless at the same time, because of the same things. Whereas I played Dead Space 3 with somebody, and it was just funny because it was just
but
bad when it comes
to
Dead
Space. I think Dead Space tried to be,
you know.
And that's another franchise. And, you know, just to kind of point out that it wasn't just the Japanese, Dead Space was pretty much Resident Evil 3-generation transition into 3 games. It was pretty much, it was pure horror, then we're going to mix it up and kind of make the story goofy, and then we're just going to go action and co-op. And that was pretty much the evolution of Resident Evil in 3 games. So maybe it was a meta-commentary on the history of video games. They even had a spin-off in there as well with the Dead Space Real Shooter.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will say this much. I mean, there were a lot of problems, but at the same time, I think there were a lot of games I feel that kind of, you know, did do well this generation. I think I've said it before, and we'll have this discussion next week, I'm sure. Super Mario Galaxy, my favorite game this generation. Best Mario game to me. Sonic Colors, Sonic Generations, probably the 2 best 3D Sonic games of all time. Resident Evil 5, I'm a huge fan of. Street Fighter 4 is up there as one of the best Street Fighter games. Mortal Kombat 9, or Mortal Kombat as they want to call it, A Great Resurrection. Mega Man 9 and 10 was probably better than anything they did in the last decade. So there were games that kind of got it right this generation, just as much as there were franchises that got it wrong.
I think that's kind of a very good summation of sort of the generation in general, because, I mean, like, you can't argue that games have never been any better, because, you know, if Minecraft can sell 100 bajillion million copies, you know, and that was one guy just working on something that he thought that he would be interested in, you know, and yet we can have things, and I mean, yes, we have the whole buy all our DLC for $84.94 before the games come out, but we also have all these cool things with how easy it is to play with people online, and, you know, the experiences we can get with people online, and things like Journey, where it has online, but you don't know who you're playing with, and you will never get to speak to them, but it's still great, you know? You know, I mean, it's really weird to think that, I mean, yes, I'm the king of complaining almost, but I can't deny that, you know, I was getting really sort of tired with Pokemon and stuff. Pokemon, when it came to Black, I thought, oh, this game is crap. This is the worst one. And I'm playing Pokemon X right now, and I just love it. I love everything about it, every single little thing that it does, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a great generation overall. I think your example of Minecraft, though, again, I really didn't want this to be a complaining show, does speak to the problem with this industry, in that Minecraft was the idea of one person who had a vision. Compare it to something like Assassin's Creed, which is the vision of like 1,000 people. And it tends to be a mess. And I think that's where we're kind of heading in this next generation. And I think that's something we'll probably hold off for more in 2 weeks as to where we're seeing these consoles going. But the idea is that we're kind of getting back to this old school, somebody in their basement making a game, and then you kind of have a game by committee where there's a bunch of, you know, there's publishers, there's market research, there's developers, all like, we need to have this and that in our game to make it successful. When you have somebody like Minecraft, and Minecraft, I think more than any other game this generation proved that, you know, you don't need the best technology, you don't need the most advanced graphics, you don't need to be technically sound in any regard. You just need to be fun, different, and compelling.
Yeah, I mean, the old saying goes, too many cooks spoil the broth, and I don't think, I mean, video game publishers, it's evident they don't understand that at the moment, you know, and it's a shame, really, because, you know, when we had, you know, back in the PS2 era, you know, we had games like Timesplitters, which were, you know, there were amazing games because they were just fun to play, and they were just like, it was a small group of maybe 40 or 50 people, you know, maybe even less than that, that just, you know, they knew what they were going for, they weren't going to listen to anybody, they were going to make what they wanted to make, and they wanted to make it well. And, you know, now we've got 1,000 people working on Assassin's Creed because we need to get the next one out for the next year, because for some reason we need one every year.
Games are only going to get more expensive. That's not going away anytime soon.
I will say this is a weird complaint, but your Assassin's Creed and your Time Spinners are reminding me of this. Is I think we get too many good games at once. And that's an odd complaint. That's an odd...
Oh, boo-hoo! Oh, poor me.
But what I mean by that is back in the olden days, and this where you just sound, but back, you know, back in like the PS2, N64 era, especially with the N64, is you got like one or two major games every quarter. So what you tended to do then is you would check out the B-tier games, you'd check out the C-tier games to kind of fill in the gaps. So you'd get stuff like Time Finish, you'll get stuff like Black, you'll get stuff like, you know, Everything or Nothing. You'll get, you'll get stuff like Gilver, you'll get stuff like Sphinx and the Curse Mum, you'll get stuff like Beyond Good and Evil. Those type of games that aren't those AAA affairs, they aren't those November titles that can go on and make 100 million open day, but they were games you bought because there was a gap between GTA 3 and, I don't know, the next Metal Gear Solid game or something like that. And yeah, nowadays, it's like you can pretty much plan your schedule for next year already. You know, you're going to get Madden, you're going to get FIFA, you're going to get a new Call of Duty, you're going to get a new Assassin's Creed. You know, you're going to get, you know, you're probably going to get GTA 5 expansion packs and DLC. You're going to get a new Need for Speed. You're going to, you know, you're going to get a WWE game, you're going to get an NBA game. You're going to get MLB games. And after a while, it's just like, you get the staples out, the games that come out every year now, and your calendar is already kind of filled up, especially around this time of the year, which gives less and less room for those experimental games to kind of make an impact, which is why, for the last couple of years, you've got like one or two major new IPs that break through. You know, The Last of Us, Dishonored, Borderlands, stuff like that, and everything else just kind of goes by the wayside because we already kind of are pre-programmed for this. I mean, look at it this year. Like, we've had Batman, we've had GTA, we've had A Saints Row already. And that, you know, we're getting a Battlefield, we're getting Assassin's Creed, a Call of Duty. Like, really, for that's six major games, that's $360. What else money do you have to spend on other games?
I just didn't want to interrupt your speech. You were kind of going. It's almost bringing me to tears there.
But it's a weird problem to think about, but it is one of those things where,
well,
again,
we've said this many times when you come, like when you compare it to movies, is we don't have. There aren't that many massive releases at one time. Rarely do we get like three of them within a few weeks of each other. And you know, obviously, we've got Ubisoft, you know, releasing whatever game at the same time as a Halo remake, and you know, we've got an Assassin's Creed coming out the same day as a Battlefield game. We've got, you know, a Call of Duty coming, and we've just had GTA 5. Oversaturation is a very big problem, and it's the reason why I find myself buying. I don't buy AAA games that much anymore because I just don't have, I don't have time for them. I have a life, I've got university to deal with. I don't have the money to do it, and it's why I like. One of the reasons I like PC the most is I can buy, you know, a game like Torchlight 2 or, you know, The Stanley Parable, and the Torchlight 2 will last me forever and I can play it in 1 hour chunks if I need to. And The Stanley Parable is something that's kind of quirky, it's kind of experimental, it knows what it is, and I can do it in, I can complete it in an hour and a half, and I can get, like, what it wanted to tell me, and I don't have to worry about DLC for it, you know, because, you know, it's the kind of game that doesn't support DLC because of the way it's talking to me. And that's the problem. Maybe with the advent of the PS4 and Xbox One and the Wii U, we have the same kind of thing where people are just like, oh, I'm not buying these AAA games. I'd rather pick up these, you know, more experimental indie games that cost me less and take less time.
I was going to say there is a problem with that, but that I think is something we should say for a later date. I guess, you know, with this conversation, I feel like it's something we should touch on. What were some of your more underrated games of this generation? Games you feel like more people should have played or you don't hear talked about enough?
I don't know. I'm not... Because a lot of the games that I've taken to playing nowadays are kind of niche games anyway. I mean, Phoenix Wright, for example, you know, most people that play them love them, but not many people play them, but they're not really for everyone. So I don't really know, because it's a very hard question to answer.
Yeah, I learn about games because other people play them, love them, and talk about them, and that's how I decide what games I want to play. So
you
I don't.
Oh, you don't go out. Like, I don't do this anymore as often, but I used to go to a GameStop when they had buy two get one free sale, and I would just kind of pick up a game I was kind of interested in or never, you know, you didn't really hear much about it and try it out. I've said this before, and I get a lot of crap for this. It's not for everybody, but one of my favorite games of this generation, and I feel something that's really underrated, was Alpha Protocol. I think it's a phenomenal Western RPG. It was, you know, it was kind of shoddy on the technical side, but I think the idea and implementation of like, the choice system was phenomenal, and something I feel like Mass Effect, like, compared to Mass Effect, it does it so much better, and I feel like it doesn't get enough credit. I could probably have an entire podcast on the underrated library for the Wii. I feel like almost anything that wasn't Nintendo got ignored by most people because it didn't fit the narrative that it was a casual system or it was filled with shovelware. But stuff like Deadly Creatures, The Blob, Red Steel 2, GoldenEye Wii, there was a ton of fantastic No More Heroes, House of the Dead Overkill. A lot of great games came out on that system that could be had for cheap, and they were very different than your typical AAA affair. On the Xbox side, I mean, I already mentioned Alpha Protocol, another game I enjoyed. And this also goes into the fact that I love spies, but I think Bourne Conspiracy was a really fun third-person beat-em-up.
I remember thinking that was all right. I did actually play that one, but that was just, I love Jason Bourne so much that I picked that
pretty
game
much,
up.
Pretty much the same reason I did. I mean, granted, it's pretty much the first movie condensed.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing spectacular about it, but it was certainly not bad.
Yeah, and we don't get many games like that in general.
Yeah.
But I remember having a ton of fun with that.
If only they weren't $60 still.
Yeah, see, that's the problem. And it's a very weird circle we go in with video games in that prices collapse really quickly, but if you wait too long, they go really high up because those games become super rare.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are just some of the games I could think of because I enjoy, and like I said, again, going back to what I was mentioning before, I think that's part of the problem is like at the start of the generation when there are far and few games coming out, that's when you try everything. When I got my Xbox 360, I tried Condemned, I tried Dead Space, I tried Lost Planet, I tried anything because you weren't getting that many games.
You know, I'm kind of skeptical whether we'll have the same thing with the coming generation because we've got a Call of Duty game coming out on the launch of the new consoles. We've got a Battlefield game coming out on the launch of the new consoles. We've got Assassin's Creed coming out on the launch of the new consoles. We have FIFA on the launch of the new consoles. I really don't think that this is going to happen. I mean, what if Sony's like magic new indie stance? I mean, maybe it's possible, but I honestly don't think it's going to happen because, you know, when I was at Eurogamer, the big lines were for Titanfall, which is just Call of Duty again. Battlefield, which is the same thing it's been for years. You know, Call of Duty, Forza, you know, the big lines. And all of these games are on next-generation systems, so I really don't think that that's going to happen this time around. And it's actually kind of disappointing. Because
yeah, and that's kind of what I was talking about, is that we are so kind of set in these major titles coming out every year that it's harder and harder to kind of get those experimental titles that didn't have those big budgets. I mean, we had the first half of this generation, we had a lot of those games, but what happened is they didn't find a market and they didn't sell well, so a lot of those studios closed down, or a lot of those studios got folded into making Assassin's Creed or Battlefield or Call of Duty because we need 500-600 people working on that instead of 100 people working on 5 different games. As I said, I think we're going to see that push where it's indie versus kind of big AAA titles, and there isn't going to be much of a middle ground between that. And that really does make me sad, but I think that's something we should hold off to until we talk about what we expect from the next generation in 2 weeks. But yeah, going back to a question I asked like half an hour ago that we never answered, is like, what did you think was the most graphic-y, I guess technic-y and artistic-y combined game of this generation, or games that you thought were a great melody of the two?
I think I'm going to stick with Halo 4 because it's not super realistic. It's still sort of very grounded in its kind of very kind of J.J. Abrams kind of. I mean, it became more J.J. Abrams kind of shiny sci-fi with Halo 4, and I kind of like that. You know, it's not like grey, super realistic, but it's kind of, it's very, like, especially with Halo 4, it's very high fidelity, even on a machine that's like now 8 years old.
I think my only problem with Halo 4 is the overabundance of blue lighting.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it definitely has an J.J. Abrams effect going on to it.
But you're going to find that in most of the games that aim for, like, technical graphic prowess than art style anyway, because Crysis has the same problem, Battlefield has the same problem.
I'm having a problem finding a game that I like just for the graphics. Like, I think of games as a package together. I almost dropped my mic. I think of the games as packaged together, so I think of the graphics as just supplementing what the gameplay has to offer. So when I think of games, I think that game had really good gameplay and a visual style that worked with it. So something like Mirror's Edge, like that game
that's
had
right.
a great
that's
style
right.
to go with it. That might actually be the best looking game in my opinion. Like, as weird as that is, like, merge of artistic style with gameplay that's fun and unique.
That's actually a good choice. It's a nice, clean style, and it's a style that's built into the design of the game with, like, you know, it uses the reds to highlight stuff, but it's really a nice
yeah.
contrast against the
And it's good design, so you always know where you need to be running, despite yeah. the fact that things are really, really open.
And it hasn't really been replicated since, either.
No, because it's a very Not hard yet. Style to pull off. It's a very neat-looking game. I'm going to cheat a bit. I mean, personally speaking, I think my favorite looking game of this generation is Kirby's Epic Yarn, but that's not a technical achievement.
That counts. That absolutely counts.
No, it counts as an artistic style, but I mean, technically, it's nothing you can't see. I was going to say, I think it would be Galaxy. I think Mario has a nice, precise style.
Yeah, okay. Mario Galaxy 2 is also really up there, you're right.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching Brad Shoemaker play it yesterday on the Giant Bomb Extra Life, and, you know, for a game that's 6 years old, built on, I guess, at this point, 12-year-old technology, it still holds up because it's a very neatly done game.
Yeah. I think I appreciate, like, smoothness of gameplay the most in graphics. So, like Vanquish and things like that, or Mario Galaxy, as you said, is very smooth. It runs very smooth. It flows from movements to one another, and like when you pay attention to like the transition animations and movements, and I want a game to flow right. So that, in my opinion, is the most impressive thing graphically that a game can do.
Yeah.
Don't have good examples for you off the top of my head, but I'll keep working on that.
Well, I'm trying to think of a game, like, you know, Mirror's Edge you mentioned, I think that's phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah, that one.
Mario works as well. So, I think Minecraft is another one. That, again, it's nothing fancy technically, but I think it gives that, because it's so rough around the edges, it does kind of give it its very unique charm.
It's distinct. You know, you can point to a picture of Minecraft to, like, any random mom or dad on the street, and they can identify what that game is.
Yeah, and you know, that's all I ask for in the game, is a kind of a uniform art style that works for it. Not And this is why I kind of hate when you go for photorealism, because there's nothing distinct about Battlefield style, even though I would consider it one of the most technically sound games of the generation. I would also say the same thing about The Last of Us, where it's a technical marvel, but it's nothing, I don't know, I mean, I haven't played the game, so maybe there are enemies and maybe there are places, but because you have to replicate the real world, you're kind of limited by what you can do with it.
The Last of Us kind of, it kind of has a weird, it's not weird, it's interesting kind of mix between kind of a realistic art style and slightly Uncharted still. I mean, I know it's built on the same engine, but it's still, like, Uncharted has a kind of, it's almost cartoony a little bit. And The Last of Us has a very good kind of in-between between a realistic and an Uncharted kind of art style, which works really well for it, actually. It's kind of, you can tell that it's not quite right, but it still works. I don't know what I'm trying to say. It's very...
I kind of get it, and for some reason it made me think it is, even though I think a lot of people agree that the game is ugly, but I think it's ugly by design, would be Gears of War.
Yes, the game is not supposed to be attractive at all.
It builds the world because it's so ugly, it's so messy, it's so broken, but it works because the enemies are not nice looking creatures, but they're monsters.
And it's not a particularly great situation that humanity has found itself in either.
Exactly.
Where there's giant things that come out of the ground and just chomp you in half with no, you know, remorse.
And it makes everything seem more... It makes everything seem more over the top, I guess, when you have these big Boken men as well.
Yeah.
And I never got if that was them or if it was the armor they were wearing. But I guess they answered that in Gears of War 3 when they took off the sheaves and shed their arms and stuff like that. But yeah, that's a game that style matches its gameplay because it's a big, messy, gross world and they live in this. And it does make you feel for them. And it's a technical marvel as well. So yeah, it is Gears of War. But yeah, there are, you know, then there's the David Cage type deals where you get stuff like Heavy Rain and Beyond Two Souls, which have great human models. But again, nothing that really stands out as far as design goes.
And the thing is, the thing about David Cage's experiences, I don't want to jump in with other games or not, is they don't tell very realistic stories. So it kind of baffles me a bit that he tries to go for a very realistic kind of art style for it. I mean, I think David Cage's stories could really benefit from some sort of artistic flair to them, because it might make the somewhat ridiculous stories easy to swallow if they do. If you know that this is a sort of a universe that's not like the one we're currently in.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, is there anything else you folks want to talk about? I mean, there's so much to say about this generation, but I do think we should start kind of wrapping. It's been almost 2 hours.
I mean, I honestly do think that, you know, we couldn't have it better than we currently do. I can play Pokemon wherever I am in the world, because I have a device that has a battery and two screens in it. You know, I can download entire games from my room and I don't have to move if I don't want to. I can play with people who live in Australia and talk to them as if they were sitting next to me. What's not to like? I mean, yeah, we get screwed over a lot and I complain about that a lot, but that, you know, things get worse as they get better also.
Okay. Sam?
Food is not a
game.
Cooking Mama.
Okay, fair enough.
No, I don't know. I've talked about this before, but I have a huge love for downloadable games. My favorite game of the last generation was Bastion, and I think games like that deserve to be recognized and remembered for what they are, because they sort of get lost in the shuffle whenever you talk about what's the best of the last generation. Bastion and Splunky were probably two of my top five.
And that was another game that had a really nice art style. I think more than that, it had a very unique storytelling mechanic as well.
Yeah, I have so much love for Bastion that I could talk about it for hours, but I'm hungry, so I won't do that.
As for me, I think it was an interesting generation. I don't necessarily think it was my favorite, even though I think I have more games this generation than any before it. I just feel like I have more because it went on longer and I had more systems to play around with. But that said, I couldn't complain about it. It was a huge thing for me, especially with online co-op games becoming a really dominant presence in the gaming world, to be able to play with friends from around the world and keep in contact with them. You know, online in general. I mean, I'm not a competitive person, but I do like playing with friends. I do like playing with people I know and getting to know people. I mean, he's not here this week. I got to know Jason because he was a huge fan of The Perfect Dark when that was coming out for Xbox Live Arcade and stuff like that. We asked him about that someday. He wasn't the greatest fan when it actually came out, but whatever. Stuff like that. I got a ton of interesting experiments, even if they were more centered at the start of the generation. I am probably in the minority with this as well. I'm a huge fan of motion controls. I've mentioned before, I enjoyed, you know, stuff like Wii Sports and Wii Sports Resort, Just Dance, Dance Central, a lot of the shooters that came out on the Wii, stuff like that, the Gunstringer. It offered a different type of experiment. It didn't work all the time, but nothing ever does. When it did work, it created some phenomenal experiences. It helped enhance a lot of great games. And, you know, like, yes, there were stuff that made it worse. But, you know, we could say that about microtransactions. We can say that about online passes. We can say that about DLC. So, no, it's not a perfect system, but nothing ever is. There were just enough good games that came out for me to actually enjoy that movement. And, yeah, we also got a ton of great downloadable titles. I enjoyed the notion of cheap games I can pick up anytime I want. When I'm in between a game or when I'm finished with something, I can just go on Xbox Live or PSN or WiiWare or the eShop or Steam, and I could find something for $2.50 if it's a good week on Steam, or I could find something for $10 that would keep me occupied for a weekend and, you know, turned out to be a phenomenal experience. Stuff like Castle Crashers, stuff like Bastion. Stuff like Fruity, stuff like Grosswind, stuff like Dead Motion.
I'm not sure that I would... no, I'm being serious. I'm not saying it just because I can. I'm not sure that I would have gotten to play Ace Attorney 5 if downloadable games weren't a thing.
Oh, and that's something that I think that's going to be very important next generation, is having this different avenue where you don't have to, you know, putting out a retail release isn't cheap, because you need to get shelf space, you need to kind of get this printed. Online does kind of help, you know, lessen that cost in a lot of degrees. And this is something that probably, you know, I rag on a lot, but I actually am really appreciative of the gaming community this generation. I think, you know, we mentioned online gaming, we mentioned all that stuff that came with it, but one of the bigger things that came with it was the social aspect of Twitter and Facebook and video game forums, and kind of getting this, you know, this huge community that could galvanize and be active together when needed. Sometimes it was unnecessary, sometimes it can be a bit dog-headed and it can be annoying. But we did get stuff, you know, like Operation Rainfall, we mentioned earlier, where, you know, gamers united to help, you know, get Nintendo to bring over these three RPGs. The Mass Effect 3 ending. A DLC practice for a lot of games. I mean, one of the reasons we're seeing online passes go away now is because gamers rebelled against it. Recently, the PS4 No DRM campaign that got Sony to not do it, and then Microsoft relented and went back on their word as well. So yeah, there's been a lot of positives that come out of the fact that the video game community is able to speak for themselves as a collective. And especially being in light of the fact that I think a lot of game journalists don't necessarily speak for the community they represent, we were able to get a voice and speak up and do stuff like that. So that was a big part of this generation. And yes, like you said, there is a lot of negative that comes with, you know, any gains, but the gains of being able to directly speak and communicate with a lot of developers and publishers around the world is a very valuable tool in and of itself. So, yeah, you know, okay, just before we begin, Sam, you want to plug your site that you didn't get to this week?
Oh, InsideGamingDaily.com. It's Machinima's blog. Go read it. I write for them.
There you go. But yes, we'll be back next week with our Games of the Generation podcast. I don't necessarily think we're going to do it the same way we did the last four, where we had a list and everybody just kind of agreed. I think this one's going to have to be a vote verbally, where we all get to argue. The same way we do our Game of the Year picks. Because I do think Game of the Generation is that important that it should be something that we do live and not necessarily something we pre-vote on.
Oh, how much do I have to pay you to get Ace Attorney 5 to be Game of the Generation?
But Ace Attorney 5 is a 3DS game, so it's not part of the last generation.
Well, now, how much do I have to pay you to get you to count it as a game of the last generation? And how much do I have to get you to pay... How much more do I have to pay you to get you to count it as a game of the generation?
Well, I mean, I don't know how you're going to convince me that it's not Mario Galaxy 1 or 2, but I look forward to that.
Maybe I could rename the games. I could convince Capcom to rename the games to Mario Galaxy.
I'm not hearing the word Splunky thrown around nearly as much as it should be.
Yeah, we're going to have... I'm sure, if you listen to us, if you know, it's going to come down to the usual. It's probably going to be a Mass Effect game. It's going to be Ace Attorney.
Like hell, it'll be a Mass Effect game.
It's going to, Jason's going to nominate it. It's going to be, there's going to be a lot of games, and I assume we're going to all agree at the end on that one game, because just like we do every game of the year, we agree on one game after arguing it for an hour. That never works. So yes, join us for that. Well, you know, we also have the survey up on the site. There's a couple of questions we answered. I think we already answered like 3 or 4 of them on this show. There's like 30 questions on the actual survey. You know, fill it out, whatever. I just like to hear, you know, people's thoughts on this generation. I love hearing about people's gaming habits and trends and stuff like that. You can find us at www.nerdsontherocks.com. You can check us out on Twitter at @dual_wielding. You can find us on Twitter at @dualwielding. I think we're on Google Plus. I don't actually use it, so I wouldn't know what we do there. So yeah, there's that. Yeah, check it out. We have up, I think by the time this goes up, or at least this week, I should have my Batman Arkham Origins review up. And we'll probably have some other Pokemon thoughts as well. For Anthony, who stepped out early, for Daniel, Sam, and myself, this has been Dual Wielding's Game of the Generation discussion.
I'm waving at the microphone. I don't know if it's working.